Honestly, I don't know how you can't know about intelligent squid.
That's brilliant.
You're listening to Shade, the podcast where I chat to creatives and activists who challenge ideas on race at a time when identity politics is at the forefront of our cultural landscapes. I'm Lou Mensah, writer and photographer, and I've always wondered why people create the work that they do. Intelligent Squared has established itself as the leading forum for live, agenda-setting debates, talks and discussions around the world. Now this week I chat with Farah Jasset, Head of Editorial Innovation and Digital. We talk about how she started debating back at uni, where she got the opportunity to interview Jesse Jackson, age 19. We talk about how Intelligent Squared has recently partnered with the New York Times and how they launched a huge event to celebrate that partnership, where the journalists who broke the Harvey Weinstein story were heading the discussion. Influencer panels, these are not. What really resonated most with me about this episode was that no matter where we are from or how we are educated, we all need a platform in which to share ideas, to engage with others, not only those who mirror our own views, but with those who also challenge them.
So Intelligent Squared is one of the leading platforms for live discussion and debate in London. We hold events in central London for usually up to 1,000 people, and they're often debates. So we'll have the traditional Oxford-style format where you have two people on either side of the motion debating against each other and then discussing with the audience. We also have lots of sort of big-in conversations. So we're lucky that our brand is quite well-known, so we're able to get speakers such as Malala, Sheryl Sandberg, Mary Beard. We've recently partnered with the New York Times, so they are now our media partner.
I saw that. What a fantastic collaboration.
Really amazing. And we've launched this new series called The Intelligent Times, which is obviously a great combination of both of our names. And the first event was a couple of weeks ago, and it was a really amazing event. It was with the reporters, the New York Times reporters, who broke the Harvey Weinstein story, Jodi Kantor and Megan Toohey. Mm. And them on stage in conversation with some of the sources in that story, so former assistants of Weinstein or former people that worked with him that were abused by him or allegedly abused by him. And we had Carrie Gracie chairing, who was the BBC presenter that was known for sort of her equal pay battle against the BBC. So it was an amazing lineup, and it was the first time I've been at an Intelligent Squared event where there's been a standing ovation from the audience of 1,000 people. It's emotional, I feel, an important story. So we're really lucky to be able to have sort of that sort of access to our speakers. And then what we do is curate events in a way that we think are interesting to our audience. So it's all about discussing ideas. It's all about challenging ideas. And it's about people who are at the forefront of leading the discussions in those fields.
What have been your personal successes as the head of editorial and innovation? And can you just tell us a little bit more about what your role involves?
Sure. So my role is officially head of editorial innovation and digital. And that essentially means that I work with other members of the editorial team. It's a very collaborative team. So we all sort of specialize in our own areas. Mine is particularly in the sort of digital sphere. So looking at podcasting, because of my background at the BBC and in radio and TV, and also in sort of innovating new ways to curate our content to be able to appeal to different audiences.
Right.
So I guess maybe two of my sort of proudest achievements so far, I've only been at the organisation for a year, has been a collaboration, a partnership that I've sort of spearheaded with Galdem.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that panel.
It was really great because we had Bernardine Evaristo, who won the Booker Prize.
On the day?
The night before, you know, the morning after the night before.
Yes.
It was really brilliant. She was obviously just still reeling from having won it with Margaret Atwood. And it was just, it felt so fresh. And we had Diane Abbott, which was really amazing because we also thought that was also due to be the day that Parliament was back from prorogation initially, yeah, before it was deemed to have not been prorogated.
Yes.
There was loads of politics happening at the time. We weren't really sure who was going to end up on stage because they'd agreed to come on, but then there were other things going on. We're lucky enough that everyone managed to turn up.
It was a perfect storm. I was just like, how is this being curated that everybody is here on this particular day? Like, it was quite amazing.
In all honesty, there was some judgment on whether we thought some people might drop out. So we had sort of spoken to other people to be part of it in case. And we, yes, were just so lucky that everyone managed to turn up. And it was just this amazing combination. So we had Bernardine Evaristo, Diane Abbott, obviously the first Black woman to go into Parliament. And the event was called Trailblazers, Women Leading the Way. So it was all about women of colour who'd managed to succeed and be pioneers in their field. We had Corinne Bailey Ray, this singer, who'd flown in that day from New York, which was amazing. We had Michelle Hussein, the Today programme presenter, Yomi Adegoke, who wrote the Black Girl Bible, Slave Your Lane, and Ash Sarkar was chairing. So it was a pretty amazing, formidable panel of women.
It was, and I would love to see more like that. What I really like is when you see the panelists taken out of the normal or the usual arena in which we're used to seeing them and put together in a new arena. And it definitely changes the dynamic of the discussion. And I loved it, the way it was so warm and open-hearted and sort of friendly and welcoming. And quite often you don't get that. I don't know what you think, but what I find about panels, quite often they're either one or the other. So I've been to lots of events where, you know, there might be whoever's being interviewed, I don't know, but I feel like the event is actually turning up because I don't always find the discussion points particularly stimulating. And I always just think, I just wish it was like, you know, these panels were like the podcasts that I listen to, a bit of personal stories with a bit of factual, you know, history and all of these things. I want to hear all of that in one go, or they're usually inaccessible to me, I feel, and I just can't quite reach the level of which the debate is at because I'm not particularly well versed in that particular area. But I felt that Girl Dem panel kind of encompassed all of that really beautifully.
I'm so pleased to hear that. I'm really thrilled because I feel like Intelligence Squared, that's what we try and do. So our job is, we don't just put these events on, because a lot of companies are able to maybe put events on, but our sort of, what we see our USP is actually editorially curating it in a way that's really engaging and interesting. And it's not just putting people on stage and assuming that magic will happen. Maybe you think it just happens spontaneously, but it's all crafted in how we brief our presenter, in the sort of questions that we're asking, in the structure of the event, which, you know, a perfect event, you don't notice the structure, you don't notice all of the scaffolding that is holding it up. It seems like it's just absolutely natural, but yes, it's actually all crafted. And then the natural element are the speakers and the way they engage with each other. But actually, there's been work going on behind the scenes trying to decide, OK, we'll ask this person this and then we'll ask this person this because they might relate to each other because of X.
Yes.
And then it does happen. And that's when magic happens on stage with the Trailblazers event. In our second installation, in a sense. So we've got one that we've just launched called Trailblazers, Letters to My Younger Self, on the 4th of Feb. And it's with Bonnie Greer, playwright, Eniola Aluko, the footballer, mm-hmm, and Chappie Corsandi, the comedian, and chaired by Clara Ampho, the BBC Radio 1.
Yeah, yeah. Good lineup.
Yeah, so we're hoping that one will be them actually... we're going to get them to write letters specifically for the event to their younger selves. And so it's a bit of advice and, quite a warm atmosphere like the last one.
Their younger self, there must have been some inkling that this is where their passion lied. So with debate or communication or observing or listening. And I don't think I've interviewed anyone yet. They have said, you know, I'm doing this. This is a sort of a happy mistake that I'm doing this job. But actually, when I look at it now, I realise that all of the threads were there from my younger self up until now. I was just sort of finding my way to it. And I'm just interested to know, when did your interest in communications begin? And how did you nurture that interest through to the role that you are in now?
It's interesting that you say that a lot of people say it was a sort of happy mistake, because I feel that really relates to me as well. Yeah. All the threads are sort of there, but yeah. I would never have realized, you know, when I was 16 or 18 going to university, I would never have imagined this would be my job now, or that I had worked at the BBC. I mean, it felt out of reach. But I was looking back, it actually all slots into place. Perhaps at university, my interest in sort of storytelling and journalism began. I used to do a bit of dabbling in the university newspaper. And I think was deputy interviews editor or some sort of position I managed to get, where I managed to interview people that came to the university on various things. And that was amazing, because I think perhaps one of the most significant ones was when Reverend Jesse Jackson came to the university and I was able to interview him. And for me, it was just amazing to have this civil rights leader who's I'm sitting with in front of me, I'm able to speak to. I mean, it's so strange coming out of school and being able to, you know, coming out of, you know, sixth form, going to university and then having such an amazing opportunity. That was so amazing. I was with a colleague of mine at uni, and it was just so much fun. So I think that's where sort of my interest in interviewing and storytelling in a sense came from. But I was always interested in the idea of debate and discussion. And I have to give credit actually to my history teacher at school, who encouraged me to go into the school debating society. And I think that he saw something, and that encouragement from him allowed me to flourish in terms of debating. So then I really got into debating and discussing different ideas. And that's where my interest in sort of communication from a public speaking perspective came from. And then it sort of all tied together when I left university. I studied history at university and I was interested in ideas. And actually I was torn between two paths. I was either going to go down the academic route and I'd applied to do a master's and got a place to do one, or go down sort of the journalism route. And then I was lucky enough to get a place on the BBC training scheme for production. So I turned down the master's offer, and I always thought I'd go back to it. And I went down the training route, and I did 2 years of training at the BBC across TV and radio and online. And then I managed to get a job with the BBC.
Wow. Okay. And that was a seminal moment with Jesse Jackson. I mean, that's life defining, isn't it? That's just such an interesting history and a path that led you to where you are.
Those moments happened in the BBC as well, just moments of real privilege where you're able to speak to someone who shaped history and you feel really humbled.
And we talked a little bit earlier about panels and debates and discussions being more inclusive. And it strikes me that Intelligence Squared is moving towards that in terms of its guest speakers and the ideas that are being discussed. But sometimes, because I didn't have a traditional sort of education, I've just felt my way to where I am now. I've not been trained in any of this. So sometimes I feel somewhat on the uneducated outside looking in, like perhaps it's not my position to be listening to or engaging with these debates. As I've grown up, I realise that that's not true at all. But that's taken many years to get to that point. I didn't come from a family where politics or culture were discussed over the dinner table. That for some probably more traditionally educated families, I used to imagine that they would have great intense debates over the dinner table about what was going on in the world, and it was one of my biggest wishes that I could have a dinner table set up like that. And now I've created one myself at home, so with my daughter and my partner we do discuss what's going on. But they're very contrasting scenarios. People who think that these kind of debates that sort of include the policy makers and decision makers, they feel that these situations aren't for them to be involved in, and that's a lot to do with background and how you grow up. My personal road to political consciousness, insofar as I've achieved anything like that, came from my young adult years. I was kind of looking for intense debate and engaging debate about what was going on in the world, and I felt like it was something that I really needed. And I found that with smaller politicized groups, as I grew up and as I grew into my identity, and some of my family members were Rastafarians, and, you know, when they got together, they would have very intense political discussions. And that was absolutely thrilling to me. It was the first time that I was involved in anything like that. And their ideas would focus around capitalism and repatriation. And then I moved on to going to college to study PR and fashion. And there was a little bit of debate there. But all of these conversations existed within echo chambers. Anti-establishment rhetoric was the norm. And in retrospect, for all of their idealism, they were perhaps unavoidably rather inward looking. And I have a few questions and thoughts when I look back at this time and these kind of debates that happen within certain groups of people. And I wonder how that you would suggest engaging people across such divides, so people who are very set in their circles of debates. How do we get these different groups talking, and how can we have more of an understanding of each other?
We see the output of those sort of inward looking tribal conversations leading to the issues we have with the Brexit referendum and Trump, and how politics is getting more and more polarized and tribal, and people are less and less willing to speak to people on the other side. I don't have an answer for that. People that are dealing with all these issues in the economy and in society and in identity politics, but maybe might not speak the language of policymakers. And because policymakers aren't speaking in their language, they feel they are not able to listen to those conversations. So they are being sort of frozen out by the language that is inaccessible, I think, from government figures. Our role is to try, as, you know, journalists, to try and represent their views in conversations that we have and allow them to maybe learn from the conversations that we are putting on in an accessible way. I think podcasting is an amazing arena that can try and democratize conversations in a way that wasn't possible before, where people can just download things for free on their phone and just listen to things. You know, there's no barrier of access that way, that everyone else has a phone. Maybe, you know, going to events is still prohibitively expensive for certain families, for certain people that live in certain parts of the country, but podcasts and the internet are a really sort of accessible way of accessing information. I think that our role is to try and market that information to those people so they realize that it's for them, and maybe, you know, maybe a route out of those echo chambers is to represent their views in a debate, but then to have it as a debate so they realize there are other perspectives and they can hear from those other perspectives. So they don't feel left out of the conversation. Have someone very articulate, maybe from their tribe or their that they respect and would follow, maybe on Twitter or on YouTube, and see them in part of a conversation with someone else with maybe a totally opposite view, that they might go into thinking, oh, I'm on the side of my person. But maybe if they go in with a bit of an open mind, they'll think, oh, this is really interesting. And both people have sort of given way slightly on certain issues.
That's what people like Akala is doing so brilliantly. He talks about such complex themes and makes them very accessible. He reaches out and becomes parts of environments and discussions that his community would previously think that they did not have access to. And through him, they are getting access. And I think it's people like that that are really helping to change and to reduce the divide.
Yeah, I think Afua Hirsch is another, being able to engage with sort of the traditional policymakers, but bringing her community in a sense and representing the voices of that community.
I interviewed for last week's episode the president of the Women's March Youth Group. She was amazing, and we talked a lot about the importance of young people being involved in debates, because it gives them the appetite and it gives them the idea that they do have a position that's valuable within society because they're being included. I wondered if you had any suggestions to parents or educators who find it difficult to know how to support children in their capacity to tackle complex themes.
I was lucky enough to have parents when I was growing up that, you know, encouraged me to question things and engaged with me and my dad in particular would speak to me about everything, even if I wouldn't completely really understand it. Mm. It's sort of, he does this with his granddaughter now, who's only 3 years old. She seems to be listening intently anyway, so I don't know, engaging from it. One of the things I would recommend is, I worked at Newsround, the CBBC programme in Salford, a few years ago, and Newsround is one of the places I genuinely believe is one of the, you know, most amazing parts of the BBC and what the licence fee pays for. Mm. It's the only programme dedicated to children and trying to explain news to them. Mm. So aimed sort of, you know, 7 to 12 year olds. And I remember we used to have to try and think of ways to explain like hurricanes or ISIS, you know, to a child of that age, which they are picking up from grown-ups around them or from random things they're seeing on the news channel when their parents are flicking through. And it is very scary. I think that's one resource I would really recommend. I feel that they are an amazing group of people that are trying to sort of explain news in an accessible way to children. The other way, the only thing I would say as sort of educators, maybe it's about humanizing the conversation, because these children will be growing up now in such a politicized environment that, as we spoke about before, people are very tribal in their thinking and their groups. You can very easily think the people that voted this way are bad people, they're racist people, all together as a block, not understanding the reasoning behind why people voted a certain way or why people are voting for a certain political party and branding all people from that political party to be a certain type. That's, I think, a very dangerous language to be using. We might strongly disagree with a person's politics, as long as they're not, you know, veering into, you know, racism and discrimination. But we have to humanize why, and even if they are veering into things like racism and discrimination, we need to understand the worries they have and then tackle them head on. I think it's important to look at the causes of why people think a certain way. And we can explain that to kids, just saying, you know, this person is worried about their job because 10 years ago they were able to have a stable job and now they're not. And so they're a bit worried that these other people are taking them. But actually the situation is that's not happening. And this is, you know, just try and explain a little bit more about why they're worried and why it's not true, but they think that, and therefore how we have to tackle it. I think maybe humanising could go a small way in trying to educate our children politically.
And finally, I hope you don't mind, actually, but I'd like to end on a personal note, because this is something that I really enjoy, this part of the podcast, asking my guests, when you're feeling the need to retreat for downtime, especially in the demanding job that you have, I'd love to hear what creative inspirations you find that you return to give you that energy again to go back and to do the work that you do.
In all honesty, the thing that I return to most is my family and my spirituality, my faith. I feel that they both ground me and center me. So those are the things that I would return to in terms of, you know, when things might get overwhelming, they bring me comfort and solace and peace. I'm lucky enough that in my job, I'm always sort of surrounded by new books. So I'm always reading new books. A book I do go back to, actually, is Elif Shafak's The 40 Rules of Love. I really do love that book. I don't know why. I think I discovered it when I was much younger. And it was the first book I'd sort of come across that was a fiction, but about like a Muslim character of history. And it was just so new to me. I was like, wow, this is amazing. I didn't know that this could happen, you know, because you don't see yourself or your culture represented in fiction or represented in, you know, the media, which is also, you know, part of my journey into that. So when you find those bits, especially when you're younger, they have sort of an unusual impact on you because you're very close to them. Similarly with Mallory Blackman's books.
Yes.
Noughts and Crosses. And sometimes I do go back to those childhood books.
Zadie Smith kind of always offered that for me, you know, with her talking about her mixed heritage and all of the issues that come with that growing up in North London. That was the first time that I saw myself really in literature. So it's so interesting. But what a delicious position that you're in. One thing I miss about being in the office is the access to some wonderful things, literature and people. And, you know, so but I get to do it from talking to you guys on here. So that's fantastic.